Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Last Tuesday morning, you tuned in and learned a new word, squiggonometry. Today, we're going to open the show with a Finnish lesson, and the word for today is hauska. Then we move on to learn about an NVU Johnson professor's research into laughing babies. We'll open the phones at 10 and wrap up the show with a franchise coach and consultant. But first, Finland. I used to ask a trivia question about what country had the most cell phone owners per capita. It was the same country that had the most newspaper readers per capita, and the answer was Finland. This morning, we're going to learn a Finnish word that is also the name of a company based in Burke that makes beautiful decorative accessories made from upcycled materials. The word is hauska, and joining me now to share the hauska story is its founder, Anne Nygaard. Anne, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Anne about hauska, or if you already are a fan of its creations, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And if you'd like to see what they make, you can visit hauska, hauska.com. All right. Hauska means what in Finnish, Anne?
Hauska means fun.
Oh, of course.
Hauska means fun, right? And yeah. With the two A's on the end, it means fun. With only one A, it means funny. So I actually started with one A, and then it was recommended that I put two. And so here we have it. We have fun houses.
I love it. Are there any other Finnish words that we should learn before we engage on this journey this morning?
Well, a good one is always kiitos. And kiitos means thank you.
Oh, kiitos. Oh. Yeah. Good. I'll try to remember that at the end when we finish this. What is hauska the company?
Hauska the company is a home decor company, as you said, based here in Burke, Vermont. And we used upcycled wood from our local furniture makers to make little wooden candle holders that are a modern holiday village. So a lot of people are familiar with, for example, their grandparents' holiday village that they would collect a piece every year. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of the modern variety of it with a new sustainable resource and very sleek modern design. And they are each has a shiny copper candle holder pipe in the top of it that serves as a chimney.
Mm. How and when did hauska get started?
Hauska started, it was my brainchild in 2019. I joined our local makerspace, The Foundry, with the hope of making gifts for Christmas. And I started making this little modern holiday village and giving them away, and it was so well received. Yep. That by February, I ended up founding hauska and putting a website together and selling on Etsy. And it's just been skyrocketing ever since.
How many times did you have to hear the words, oh, my God, you should sell these, before you thought, oh, my God, I should sell these?
I have to say I was dabbling in it, and I really thought, you know, here in Burke, we have 150,000 mountain bikers a year that come from Kingdom Trails, as well as skiers for Burke Mountain Resort. And I thought, you know, why don't I just sell these locally in our little cafes, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I just had so many people reaching out, I decided I better put these online. So, and then Etsy made me an editor's pick last holiday season, and things really took off.
Oh, that's fabulous. And you design all the pieces?
I do. I can actually make all the pieces. I just, the volume's gotten to the point that I now have 5 different makers.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's great. So one in West Burke, one up in Essex, another in Middlebury. And then I have 2 people that make my little wooden trees.
Oh, those trees are beautiful, too, and we'll talk about them. They do evoke this feeling of Vermont. Are you a native Vermonter, first of all?
I am. I'm born and raised in Lindenville. But my father and mother moved up here from New Jersey in the 60s. But I was born in St. Johnsbury. So I guess that makes me a Vermonter, right?
It does. maybe not to someone who's seven generations Vermonter, but to me, who's, you know, 19 years in Vermont, I think you're, you know, truly a Vermonter. But you did. So we have this Vermont company with a Finnish name because you spent time in Scandinavia. So what took you to Finland and Sweden?
Well, funnily enough, when I was in high school, I wanted to be an exchange student, and I said I wanted to speak French and ski. Those were my two requirements. And for some reason, they sent me to Finland. So
it's one of the F countries, so go on.
Right. I should have been more specific. I meant downhill skiing. Cross-country skiing is really the big thing. And Finnish is a rather complicated language, but it's a beautiful language. So I had a great time there.
And I believe Finnish, if I'm not mistaken, is more akin to the Slavic languages.
Yes.
Am I right?
Yes. Rick, it sounds like you're an aficionado of this. So a lot of people mistakenly think Finland is Scandinavian. It's Nordic rather than Scandinavia. And it the Finno-Ugric language, Hungarian and Finnish are tied together.
Yep.
So the world's largest palindrome is actually in Finnish, and I never can say it, but it's like soap salesman, and it's like 16 letters that read the same front to back.
Do you know we have a world champion? What did you just say? The longest
palindrome?
Yeah, a palindromist. A world champion palindromist lives in Middlebury now, so we'll have to get him on that word. Now, describe the look and feel of the pieces that Hauske makes.
Sure. Very minimalist, very simple, very sleek. And frankly, with these, there are no place to hide. So these are so streamlined. They're very, very modern looking. I have started with traditional Vermont houses like a cottage, a farmhouse, a colonial house, barn, church, sugar house, and schoolhouse was my original line. And they are literally two or three pieces. The wood itself is wood that has been glued together to make a solid piece and then cut and sanded to a very fine finish. So it really is very streamlined. But as I said, there's no place to hide in these. Everything is absolutely perfect, and my makers do an amazing job.
They are beautiful. You've mentioned the materials that you use that's upcycled. Explain where you get the wood that you use for these pieces.
Certainly. Right now, there's furniture makers in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, namely in Lindenville, that have piles of scrap wood that, frankly, people are taking home and using as kindling. And this wood is stunningly beautiful. A lot of it is walnut or maple. And when you glue them all together, laminate them, put them in a press, you can make a solid piece, and it is beautiful, high-end quality. And then my newest line right now is made with a thermal maple. And this is maple that is heated to about 700 degrees, and it turns it dark. So it's a chemical reaction that colors it all the way through the wood. So it looks like walnut. It feels like walnut, but it feels like Vermont maple, which is great.
We've been using the word scrap wood or upcycled, but when you see these pieces, they look so rich, and they are beautiful, but they have this feel of being the finest wood that you can get your hands on. But why is this an important element for you, this use of scrap wood?
You know, it's just important to be sustainable and environmentally conscious. And frankly, you know, I find it challenging to take things that you have around that are normal everyday things and repurpose them. I like the challenge of that.
And where does the inspiration come from the pieces you create?
You know, I was really affected, I think, by living in Northern Europe. As I had mentioned, I was an exchange student in high school, and then I studied for a year abroad at University of Stockholm. And it was really striking to me how form and function are so intertwined in Scandinavian design. Things are useful and they're beautiful, and that's just a great combination.
Now, I hate to play favorites, but I've been to 650 covered bridges, and when I saw that piece, I think you had me. Is there one that has special meaning for you?
I will say I do not have favorites. I really don't. I love them all equally, and I do take them very personally. They are like my children, in addition to my human children. So, but thank you. I'm so glad you like the covered bridge. That was new this year for 2022, and I do introduce a new building every year. And this year, I also introduced a new line, which is our retro line, and this has some of the traditional retro images that you'd be familiar with, like A-frame houses in three sizes, a ranch house that looks like the Brady Bunch house, in a very minimalist, sleek way. Mm-hmm. I have a split-level house that comes in two pieces, so you can style it the way that you would like. And then there's a retro chapel that is actually based on the Catholic chapel in Stowe, Vermont.
Oh, my gosh. About how many different designs are there now in the Hauske line?
Right now, there are 17. And in January 2023, I will launch the one for next year.
Oh, how exciting. Now, you say you started out with Etsy, and then you also have a connection with Cabot. So how'd that come about?
It is amazing the way things work.
Yeah.
I have been so blessed with having retailers reach out to me. And they see my designs in local shops in the Northeast Kingdom to start with. And then I had heard from different places across Vermont and now across New England. Cabot kindly had the conversation with me about carrying them. They work with all sorts of local artists and feature them in that beautiful annex shop in Waterbury. Mm-hmm. And the minute that I took them out of the boxes, they said, "We need to have these." and they had the most clever idea to use them on charcuterie boards.
Yes, they're big on charcuterie there. I did a show from there, and oh, what a place, right? And your designs mm-hmm. fit right in there, so I think that's fantastic. But the other thing is, you know, I think of, you know, gift shops in Middlebury or, mm-hmm. You know, in the southern part of the state and Manchester, for instance. And I could see someone perusing stuff coming, you know, from away and, mm-hmm. and seeing one of those and just their knees start to shake because they're just such a beautiful way of depicting what we have here.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad you like them. And I will say, I'm surprised I'm shipping globally now. I've shipped them to Switzerland and Japan and Australia. And when people like them, they really like them.
Yeah.
I have people that have gone through the website and picked out every single variety, every house, every single variety and ordered them all.
Wow.
There are people that really are fans.
I need the entire Hauske line. Okay, this will tell us if you've really made it. Have you shipped any to Finland?
You know, I have, but I will admit they're as gifts to people.
Okay.
And frankly, I've been trying to bring gifts to people for 35 years from the States to Finland, and I finally ran out of things, so I had to make something.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, we're going to get back to these lovely creations, but I want to delve a little into your impressive background. Because you're not just this maker of these beautiful items. Tell us about working for the Library of Congress East Africa Division.
Wow, Rick, you really went back there.
I have.
No, I've always loved to travel. And after college, I took a year in Africa and went with a friend to Rwanda and ended up meeting the East African Division librarian for U.S. Library of Congress, which is the largest library in the world. And they catalog everything published. So I used to do day trips into, at that point, it was Zaire. In Burundi and Uganda and other places to try and find mostly professors that were publishing and then buy those articles and ship them back to the U.S. Library of Congress.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. And then you've also worked at Tiffany and Company. What did you do there?
You really have gone back. So, you know, after Rwanda, I thought I needed to do something completely different. And Tiffany was about as different as you could get from Rwanda. So, I had studied textile and apparel in college and, took that knowledge and applied it to the fragrance division at Tiffany, and was a global analyst there and helped open up, their European, retail distribution, and then worked for them in the UK as well and worked for them in London.
You know, when I think of Tiffany and their elegance and then Hauska, I do see, you know, kind of a connection, a sense of design, you know, from one to the other. You're also the inaugural director of the Center for Professional Studies at NVU Linden. So tell us about that.
Sure. I'm passionate about Vermont and about our region in the Northeast Kingdom. And one way to really make an impact and help raise the standard of living in the region, which is the most rural, remote part of Vermont, is through education. So my day job is as the director of continuing education and adult learning at Northern Vermont University. And, of course, in July 2023, we're going to be Vermont State University, VTSU. So it's exciting times.
Excellent. Now, let's get back to Hauska. You mentioned you were originally on Etsy. Was there some seminal moment when you knew that, oh my gosh, this Hauska thing, this is real. It's got legs. And yeah, I better up my game because this is going.
It's funny how things just fall in place. You know, I was made the Etsy editor's pick, and then I received an email from the editors saying that they would like to feature me for the holidays last year, and they said buckle up, and they were right. They were right. So you know, I'm still working from the house, which is great, but the new announcement, actually, and you heard it here first, Rick, is the company Minted, minted.com,
yeah.
Has been in touch, and they are launching a new gift line. And they have asked Hauska to be one of the curated parts of that. So that should be launching in the beginning of September.
Oh, Anne, that is great news. Congratulations. Thanks for releasing it here on the show this morning. I don't want to leave without talking about those wonderful trees that you have. The buildings are gorgeous, but that I want a whole forest of those trees.
Sure.
Tell people about those. Yeah.
So these are made in Maine, and I came across them in a craft shop and got in touch with the owners, and now he's making them most exclusively for me. Mm-hmm. He gets blanks from a local baseball bat manufacturer, and these are the tail ends of the bats, and he hand turns them in his shop, and now we have three different finishes and four different sizes, ranging from 5 inches to 8 inches, in green, a natural maple wood, or a fringe that just has a green detail around the edge of the branches. And I will say, I cannot keep them in stock. They fly out the door.
Oh, they're the perfect complement to your homes and covered bridges and churches. We only have about 30 seconds left, but we should also talk very briefly about the fact that these items can be customized.
They can, and I'm very happy to work with people. I get to hear their stories on having things customized. A lot of people want their ski chalets or their lake houses year-round. So there's an opportunity to do that. And if you visit houseka.com or send me an email at hello@houseka.com, then we can talk about your customization project.
Fantastic. Ann Nygaard is the founder of Houseka, based in Burke. And to learn more, you can visit houseka.com. And it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Quitos?
Thank you so much.
Take care. We're going to take a break. Bye-bye. For CBS News, and then we'll return to learn about laughing babies. And the Sox are back at Fenway to open a series against the Toronto Blue Jays. We're on the air at 6:10. Action gets started at 7:10 tonight. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. If you want to make a baby laugh, I'm not sure how good our next guest is at getting a chuckle out of them, but if you want to understand why infants laugh and how they develop an understanding of humor, well then, NVU Psychology and Human Services Professor Dr. Gina Miro is the person to chat with, and she recently was awarded a National Institutes of Health grant for $547,000 to fund her proposed research, which is titled Infants' Understanding of Violations of Expectation, the Role of Social Agents of Repetition. We will find out what that means. Gina Miro is with us now to discuss her research. Gina, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And listeners, if you have any questions or comments for our guest, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Gina, at what point did you hear a baby laugh and thought, hey, what's the deal with that?
Well, I'm sure I heard babies laugh long before I really noted it as a really interesting thing.
Yeah.
And it's kind of an occupational hazard when you're a psychologist that you just tend to tune into behavior. So it was our first child. My husband and I have two grown-up kids, but when our son was an infant, he was about 3.5 months old, and we were at a really sad occasion. My father-in-law had passed away, and we were at the little reception following the funeral, and my brother was watching our son, you know, in another part of the reception, and he came running over to me and said, Al just laughed. And part of it was just the paradox of being at a sad event, and right. Then, you know, our son was laughing, which kind of changed the, I don't know, it just brought a lot of joy to the event, for me anyway, but for others who were around hearing him. And it did strike me at the time that, you know, that's such an early response, that babies laugh so early.
Mm-hmm.
And why? Why is it so early? They don't speak until they're about a year old. So why are they laughing so early? So it kind of planted a seed for me. I was actually studying grief at the time children and adults. And so it took another 10 or 12 years before I changed my course of research.
Much more exciting, I think, research. What was the first element of laughing babies that you did research?
Yeah, well, there weren't, and there still aren't, many people who study laughter in infants. But there was one psychologist at the University of Portsmouth in England, Vasu Reddy, who's become a really good friend and colleague. She was studying laughter and humor specifically in infants that were about 8 months old and older. And so I decided to kind of tag onto her work, but to start earlier. So the first thing we did was, this was with, my students are always involved in my projects. I could never do this without my wonderful students. So I had about four students working on this first project, and we recruited 30 infants, and we followed them from 3 months of age, because laughter begins about 3.5 months, but all infants, developmentally typical infants, are laughing by 4 months. So we started just before laughter comes online at 3 months, and these students went to infants' homes every month with video cameras and said to parents, do whatever you normally do to get your baby to laugh or smile. So we gave parents about 10 minutes, and the students would follow them around the house if that's what needed to happen. And it was kind of a free-for-all. Anybody could be in the room, siblings, pets, the other parents, grandparents, you name it. We just wanted to see, how does this unfold in the natural environment? So we did that for a full year. We followed these babies until their first birthdays, and we collected some other measures as well. We always collect measures of temperament. Some babies are just simply smiley by nature, and others are a little more sober. And we also looked at another variable we call attachment at 1 year to see what was the nature of the parent-child relationship, their emotional security that the baby felt at 1 year. So that was how we started. We started with this really ambitious project where students were going out into homes every month. It was great, but it was laborious.
Yeah. And then what other questions have you kind of followed that with? You know, as you've gained this bit of information, where else have you been able to take this?
Yeah, so from that first study, that sent us on to our next question. So we thought what we were observing with those first 30 babies is that when parents attempt to make a baby laugh or smile, they tend to use a lot of laughing and smiling themselves, and they also tend to use a lot of sort of wild behavior. So they, they might toss the baby in the air, or they jostle them fairly violently, or they, they're kind of doing slapstick comedy with their babies. We saw one dad and three-year-old. The baby was in like a little jumper, a Johnny jumper that, hangs from a doorway, so a little jumpy seat. And the dad and the little brother were throwing their bodies on the floor. It was hilarious, and the baby thought so too. So we thought, okay, here's what's happening. Parents are using these kind of odd social behaviors. This is a very academic way to say it. I'm sorry about
that's
that.
That's all right. That's
just
okay.
How we talk. And
yeah.
Yeah. So they're using these very odd behaviors, but they're pairing them with smiling and laughing. So we really thought babies were just catching laughter from the environment, that parents were giving them these cues, hey, this wild thing I'm doing is funny.
Right.
So we set up an experiment where we showed babies ordinary events, like an experimenter just playing with a red foam ball. And then we would and the experimenter, by the way, again, are students. and then the experimenter would use the ball they'd use the ball in an ordinary way, moving it from hand to hand, let's say, and talking about it. And then they'd put the ball on their nose. These are like those little foam clown noses you can get at a toy store. And they would just point their finger to their nose and say, beep, beep, beep. And they'd do that with a straight face. And we had a couple of different conditions. One of the conditions was we told parents, don't make a move. You just stare at the event. You are totally stoic. Don't smile. Don't laugh. Don't do anything. And then in the other condition, we'd have the parent point and laugh at the event. And we thought this was going to be an open and shut case. I just thought, oh, this is easy. The babies are going to laugh when the parents laugh, and that's it. This was with 6-month-old babies. And in fact, we found just the opposite, that when the parents left, babies were really interested in parents, so they looked at parents and were very captivated by the parents' emotion. But when the parents just stayed out of it, babies laughed at the event all by themselves. And this was before they had seen the parent laugh at it. So they, you know, they found the event funny on their own. And that was really surprising to us. I just thought, I didn't think babies would be that sophisticated. I really thought they would need, some cues from the environment. So from there, we backed up the study. We said, well, let's look at five-month-olds. Five-month-olds won't be as sophisticated as six-month-olds. They only have a month of laughing experience at that point.
Right.
But again, I was wrong. this is what I love about science. It just
Absolutely.
Keeps you honest, you know. And we found that five-month-olds also found these events really amusing when parents would stay out of it. So we backed it up one more time and looked at four-month-olds. And we didn't expect four-month-olds to laugh at these events, and they didn't. But what they did do was we hooked these little guys up to heart rate equipment. And what we found was that when the babies were looking at the absurd event, the silly event, they had a heart rate deceleration. So their heart rate dropped. And this tells us a couple of things. First of all, we know they were distinguishing the unusual event, the funny event, from the ordinary event.
Mm-hmm.
And it also tells us that they were much more captivated by that event. They would engage with it longer. It was unexpected for them. And the fact that their heart rate goes down allows them to stay more engaged, to look at it for longer, in other words. So this is just really, we can't ask infants what their experience
exactly,
is, obviously.
Right.
So it's pretty cool to just watch their behavior and then get this physiological confirmation about what's going on for them.
Oh, fascinating. Let's head to Huntington and speak with Brenda. Hi, Brenda.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I too have been impressed with the really well-developed sense of humor that babies and infants have.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of partly concluded that it was a evolved behavior so that these little kids could ingratiate themselves into their parents, before the mores happened of infanticide, so their parents wouldn't, throw them into the river because they were pain. And I wonder what your guest thinks about that idea.
Interesting theory. Thanks, Brenda.
Yeah.
Gina?
Yeah, super insightful, Brenda. Yeah, so as it turns out, there was somebody quite relevant to your question who wrote about smiling and laughter long before anybody else did, and that's Charles Darwin. So in his 1872 book called The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals, Darwin describes in great detail one of his sons' laughter, the emergence of his son's laughter. And he concludes his son is laughing at about 113 days, I think, is when he notes it.
Hmm.
So Darwin first postulated that smiling is a reflex, so newborn babies smile as well as perform many, many other reflexes like grasping or fanning their toes or startling. Those are, and breathing, blinking, those are all reflexes. And these are not under infants' voluntary control, and smiling is one of them. So infants smile indiscriminately when they're first born in the first 6 weeks of life. And one of the things that pediatricians do is they use a reflexive assessment as, just to know the baby has normal neurological functioning. So that is hardwired into the system, smiling. And it comes under voluntary control fairly early, at about 6 weeks of age, sometimes earlier. It does vary from baby to baby and sometimes a little bit later. But at that point, babies will start smiling only at specific people or things. I think that, your guess is a good one, Brenda, because certainly those first 6 weeks are rough.
They're
so rough on parents. It's so exhausting to have a newborn infant even if they're healthy and, you know, and the baby's born into fairly low stress circumstances, a baby adds a lot of stress to the system. And at about the 6-week mark, when parents may be ready to just give up, that's when infants start to smile voluntarily. And it's that, you know, 3 a.m. Smile during the feeding where mom or dad can say, okay, all right, what we're doing is working. And, you know, thanks for smiling at me. That's all I needed right now. So,
Great call. It's
definitely part of our evolutionary history. Interestingly, humans are not the only ones to laugh. So all mammals have the built-in circuitry for laughter, and juvenile mammals will make sounds during play that sound a lot like laughter. So it's sort of like a kind of panting sound that you'll hear dogs make during play, chimps do it during play, and there's even some phenomenal evidence that was first provided by a comparative psychologist, Yak Pingsep, who passed away a couple of years ago. But if you go onto YouTube and search rat laughter or rat tickling, you will be just wowed by the lab work of Yak Pingsep showing that rats do they do this chirping that is very reminiscent of laughter when they're being tickled.
Wow. We only have a few minutes left. I want to make sure we talk about this grant. And you're receiving it for something called Infants' Understanding of Violations of Expectation, the Role of Social Agents and Repetition. So help me here. What exactly will you be studying?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we study, people who study humor essentially study what are called violations of expectation. So these are silly events. Wait, what's the cup doing on your head? You know, that's not how we use a cup. Or what are you doing pretending to pour water into a shoe? That's not what we do with water or with a shoe. So a violation of expectation means that it's an event that is unexpected. Now, there's a whole other research literature that looks at infants' responses to magical events. Magical events are also violations of expectations.
Right.
So objects that defy gravity, for example, or when a solid object appears to penetrate a solid barrier. These are things that defy physics, and we can describe them as magical. And what the magic researchers have done some really interesting studies, and what they've shown is that infants can, starting at about 3.5 months, infants can detect these violations of expectation, and they tend to stare at them. So what we're investigating with this NIH funding is, why do infants stare at magical events but laugh at humorous events? What makes it, what is the distinction there for infants? So essentially, we think there's two reasons. We're testing two hypotheses. One is that in the magical research, they only show the events once. And we think, kind of like with peekaboo is not funny on the first time, but it's funny after about 5 or 6 repetitions.
Right.
We think that if you, you know, if we show infants these magic tricks repeatedly, that they might have a different response to them. Similarly, the magic researchers also have the tricks occurring by themselves. So the infants only see like the arms of a researcher. For example, they don't see the person's whole body. And we know from the humor research that one of the things that's required to get a baby to laugh, pretty much required, that's maybe a strong word, but it's pretty necessary, is a person. You have to have this be a social event.
Hmm.
So we are also going to test whether having a full person, remember these are my students, they are doing great on their magic tricks, by the way, that to have a person show a baby a magic trick might change the infant's response to it. And the reason this is important is because The folks studying infants' responses to magic have drawn some pretty big conclusions about what infants understand about the world. So since babies stare at magic tricks and detect them, the magic researchers have tended to conclude that babies have an innate sense of physics. Now, they might be right. It's just that toddlers don't do that. So the idea that infants would have this incredible understanding that would go away in toddlerhood doesn't make sense. So I really think it might be something about the methodology. So we're just going to take those magic tricks and we're going to put them, to the test using what we do in the humor research and see if infants behave the same way.
I love the whole idea of an infant sitting there and seeing somebody pull a rabbit out of the hat once. Okay. Four more times.
Yeah, no animals will be harmed in the conducting of this study.
All right. Dr. Gina Miro is an NVU psychology and human services professor. And to learn more about her research, you can visit northernvermont.edu. Gina, I want to thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Thanks so much, Rick. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we're going to open up the phones for a half hour. And coming up today at 1, we've got 3 big hours of The Getaway with Grapplin' Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at wdevradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Danny, Thunderbirds are go. Get those phones open stat. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or 291-TALK. Email is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Bill LaBeouf and the Bold Vikings throwing us a little curveball. The song is a fave of mine, Let the Day Begin, and the band is The Call. Clever. Okay, let's pick up on yesterday's theme of memorable concerts, albums, 45s, CDs. We can go there. Now, I spoke with a listener yesterday after the show, and she said that she'd rather meet me than Mick Jagger, which means she either holds Mick Jagger in pretty low regard or she was seriously trying to pump my tires. But let's go there. Who's a celebrity you've met that you came away really impressed by? I'll let you know some celebs I've interviewed who I thought were ace. And of course, the phones are open. So are the categories. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. The day you begin, yeah. All right. The lead singer of The Call is a guy named Michael Bean. And last week when we were at the antique car show, the car meet, there was a photographer there with the same name, Michael Bean. No, that's not who it was. It was a cheesemaker I met. A cheesemaker. That was at the Vermont. I go too many places. I need a secretary. It was a cheesemaker. Sorry. All right. Let's go to our first caller, bat and lead off. Oh, it is the Duke of Newbury, the Duke without portfolio, Your Grace, Fred. Good morning.
You got your stone. You got your stone pat.
You've trained me well, is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So
hey, wait. Oh, Fred, wait. Hold on. Before you get to that, you mentioned a song yesterday, And we did track it down, and it is beautiful, and we're going to play a little bit for everybody. So hold on, Fred.
Okay.
Keep your distance. And as for fortune, and as for fame, I never invited them in. Though it seemed to the world they were all I desired.
Fred, good call. Suzanne Ahrens is the singer. Yeah, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. So
it's
thanks.
Huh?
Yeah, beautiful.
It's really good. I love music.
Yeah, that was a great suggestion. Okay, what do you got for us today, Fred?
Okay, so speaking of music and people that sing and play instruments and do stage work, the most the people that get paid the most money in any society are its entertainers.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because we love to be entertained.
Yep.
We can't deal without it. We couldn't survive without entertainment. Rush Limbaugh said the reason why he has 20 million people a week listening to his show for a minimum of 15 minutes mm-hmm. is because he is a political entertainer. And it's true.
Yeah, no doubt.
You can't beat it. You can't beat it. We just love to be entertained. Even if you go back to the gladiators, they were the top entertainers of their era.
Yeah, good points.
Yeah. So anyways, we just love to be entertained. Now, I'll give you some advice. If you could have 20 million people listening to you every week, you'd be a wealthy guy.
I would. Fred, I can't even get out of the basement in your rankings of hosts of this show. There have been four hosts, and I still am in fourth place behind Mark Johnson, Dave Graham, Mike Smith, and then you always rank me fourth out of four.
I didn't like Smith. I thought he was too old.
Okay. I'm out of the basement. All right.
Yeah, so you're out of the, as far as I'm concerned, you're out of the basement. But you're right about those first two people. They were great.
Yeah.
And the reason why Dave got let go was because I think, what was his name? I'm trying to think of his name. He's the general manager of the program. He and I got into a big argument one day, and he said that Dave was too political.
Well, Fred, again, that's a personnel issue that I never dabble in.
I know. You can't get into that. Yeah. Only I could do a thing like that.
That's right. And I thank you for moving me up the line to third in the list of four hosts who have ever hosted this show. But as Danny McGivergan says, I'm still on the Mount Rushmore of this show. Yeah, because there have only been four hosts. Put two more on here, and they'll start chiseling my visage right off the mountain. All right, we've got the phones open at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Does it matter, Danny? Does it matter that a listener said yesterday she'd rather meet me than Mick Jagger? I guess it only means that Mick Jagger wouldn't make it to our show's Mount Rushmore. How about that? All right. Let's see. We got music we're talking about. You can go into the Fred category, which is whatever you want to talk about, although he gave us some good music suggestions. I have collected this list of Roger's band names. Roger Hill, our meteorologist. I like to play, "Hey, Roger, name our band, please." And I have a ton of them. Let me see. These are just phrases that I have lifted out of his weathercasts through the last couple of years, right? And so if you're looking to be a band, you could be Bizarro Climate Niches or Warm Frontal Genesis or Bombo Genesis. Now, of course, you do run the risk with those two, Warm Frontal Genesis or Bombo Genesis, that Phil Collins and the gang will file suit. Shortwave Troughs, Fringe Effects, I kind of like that one. There's Fog Eating Snow. I wonder what they would play. Fog Eating Snow. Mezzo Scale Band. These are things he just says. Bubble of High Pressure. Apache Fog. I'm sure he was saying Apache, P-A-T-C-H-Y, but I heard it as Apache Fog, like the Native American tribe. Skiff of Snow. Shady Northern Slopes. I got tons of them here. He just never stops, Roger. Feedback in Progress. I like that one. All right. Yeah. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. All right, let's see. We're talking favorite concerts you've attended, excellent band name suggestions, celebrities you've met who actually did not disappoint. I'm going to tell you a few right now. Dawn Wells, who played Mary Ann in Gilligan's Island. She had a cookbook out once, got to interview her. She was an absolute delight. Dave Matthews. We talked about, this was when he was starting out, and we talked about his music, but also he had, his family were missionaries to South Africa, so we talked about apartheid and Desmond Tutu, and it was very interesting. And then Mary Lou Henner, remember her from Taxi? She was Nardo. She had a neat book about your health, that I interviewed her about once. And she is something called hyperperthymesia. I think that's the way you pronounce it. But she is one of those people who remember everything. She can remember events from every day of her life. She's like the, Governor Jim Douglas, who remembers everybody. All right. Let's head to the phones. We got Pam joining us from Duxbury. Hi, Pam. What's going on?
Hey, Rick. How are you?
I'm fine.
So this isn't as elaborate a list as yours, but yeah, I'd rather meet you than Mick Jagger, because he wouldn't talk to me, but I know you would. So, anyway, my celebrity story, I'm sort of I've been a longtime Red Sox fan since the 60s. So I was in Boston taking a flight back to Burlington, and I spotted Bill Lee over in the corner. And he got on the same plane with me, and I'm one of those, like, I'm never going to bother somebody famous, never going to bother, never going to bother. Well, I couldn't help myself. As we're getting off the plane, it's one of those little puddle jumpers. He's right in front of me. And I said, Mr. Lee, I've been a, you know, longtime fan, yada, yada, yada. I don't suppose I could get your autograph. Keep in mind, my husband and little son were there to pick me up, and this was back in the days when you could see us getting off the plane on the tarmac. And we got off the plane. Bill was wonderful. He opened up his briefcase, whipped out a 8x10, signed it on his, he was on his knees in front of me. And I can see in the window my husband and son going, what? Like, wait a minute, she's already married. What the hell? So anyway, but I thought I caught something yesterday.
Yes.
From either... Is something happened to them?
Yeah, I'll mention that. And Pam, I'm so glad you bring up Billy Lee. It's funny when you meet him, it's like you're friends with him for your entire life. He's just,
exactly.
Right. Warm and inviting. He usually signs autographs, Earth, Bill Lee. And he's got a million funny stories. He's a really intelligent guy. And I love that he keeps playing baseball, and I'm glad you brought him up, Pam. And I'll explain what the story is. You know, it's funny. I was going to call him And I'm glad I didn't because, you know, he's in the hospital, I think still in Georgia recovering. So Bill Lee just can't stop playing ball. He plays senior league baseball up here in Vermont. I think he's still with the Burlington Cardinals, and his catcher is Burlington Mayor Moreau Weinberger. And, you know, he's still, I think he's making bats. He's got some wine named after him. But he was down with the Savannah Bananas, which is part baseball, part theater. I'm not sure how much actual baseball they play, but very entertaining stuff. And Billy Lee was going to be pitching. I think he was warming up in the bullpen and collapsed. And so this whole Savannah Banana thing is a lot of camp and theater. And at first, people thought that he actually was just playing around like Bill Lee will do. But no, he did, I think they said his heart might have stopped, for, you know, a moment or two, but, he was revived, taken to the hospital and recuperating right now. And I'll try to learn more about him, but I do want to give the family, you know, certainly, their space. And then I'll try to reach out and see if we can't hear from Billy. He would probably, do the show right now from his hospital bed. But okay, here's what Danny found. Had a cardiac episode that stopped his breathing. Thunderbolt off duty, firefighters, police officers, and others helped save Lee's life. Okay, so Billy Lee still kicking. I'm sure he'll take about a week off and then be ready to pitch again somewhere because that's what he loves to do. But boy, I love that story, Pam. Bill Lee is one of those celebrities who do not disappoint. And you know, Danny, you know, said never meet your heroes, and that happens quite often. But I'll mention a few people who I back in the day when I worked at Palm Beach Polo and Country Club, we had celebrities who would come in for polo or for different things. And at one point, we had some of the crew of Miami Vice come up. There was a fundraiser. And I got to meet Sandra Santiago and Brian Dennehy. And quite frankly, you couldn't meet two more lovely human beings. Stuart Copeland, who I mentioned yesterday, we played some of the music from his band Animal Logic after he left the police. He was the drummer, came to Polo and got to meet him. And all right, I'll tell you this little story. I got time. We got nobody calling. But the numbers are 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. So when you were working at the Polo Club, celebrities would come in and you would always just treat them like another human being. You would not ask for autographs or chat them up. You'd just be as kind to them as you possibly could. Well, everyone knew that I was a massive police fan and Stuart Copeland fan. And so the word went out that he was having lunch at the Polo Club. And they called my office. And so I drove across the grounds. I took with me some manila folders. Like I was doing work, right? And I walked through the Polo Club. And I mean, I know where he's sitting. The place is empty. There's Stuart Copeland. He's a tall, thin, you know, guy. And, I do this fake double take. Oh, hey, it's Stuart Copeland. And I walk over and chat him up. And, we talked about, his solo music at the time he was doing the soundtrack for the TV show, The Equalizer. And, he had done this really cool, album called The Rhythmatist, which he went to Africa and worked with African artists and came back and released this album. And we chatted about it, and then Graceland had come out since then, Paul Simons. And I, you know, he said, well, and, you know, Graceland. And I said, well, you did it first. And he said, yeah, but Paul Simon did it right. which is a humbling statement. You know, he went over with an idea and captured the music and put it on an album, and it was really cool. And then Paul Simon, well, what he did with Graceland was pretty phenomenal. A couple other people who I met through that, Bill Devane, Jane Seymour, Doug Sheehan, all actors who came in to play Polo, and they couldn't be nicer individuals. So sometimes you do indeed get to meet your heroes. Okay, also on Bill Lee, paramedics, two shocks with a defibrillator helped resuscitate Bill. He's 75 years old. That was according to a witness on the scene. All right. Yesterday we talked some music too and had a call from a listener. I got this after I went off the air and I've done a little bit of investigation, but if anybody knows more about this, so Foghat had their best album, Fool for the City, was actually recorded here in Vermont, recorded at Suntreater, I guess that's how you would say it, Suntreater Studios in Sharon. And so this would have been back in the 70s, but Slow Ride, I think, came off of that. So if anyone knows more information about when Foghat was here recording Fool for the City at Suntreater Studios in Sharon, maybe, you know, you were the person, you know, running for their drinks, or you mixed the sound. Boy, I'd love to hear from you and learn more about when Foghat was here back in the day. That would be pretty cool. And I thank to whomever it was who called in with that bit of information. I did some very cursory diving into finding info, and it is true. The person who called got it right. It did happen, but then there's also Deep Purple. It was here, and I think they recorded, or they hung out in Stowe for a while too. But that's, again, if anyone knows those stories, you met up with them, you did work for them, you mixed the sound, whatever you might have done, tuned their amps or their guitars. You don't tune an amp, do you? No, you tune a guitar. How many bands have I played in? All right, Danny, I think we've reached the end of our tether. Let's dig that big rubber stopper in the open phones and end this for another day. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we'll be back to discuss franchising with someone who knows this subject quite well. And just ahead at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. We've talked about baubles, babies, and big stars so far this morning. Now let's discuss business. Specifically, let's talk about franchising. Franchising can be a way to business ownership with built-ins that can get you to a goal on a quicker path. But there are a lot of options out there, and it's not always easy sorting through them and finding ones that make sense for you. What you need is a coach, someone you can consult with. Dan Hayes is a certified franchise consultant based here in Vermont and is the owner of 100 Acre Consulting, and he's with us now. Dan, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Dan a question about franchising, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Dan, I can remember, I'm going to call it the rise of franchising, but maybe from the 60s through the 80s. Is this still a thing, a big thing?
Well, actually, nowadays it's, you know, extremely dynamic. But yeah, that was, franchising. They used to franchise properties back in the 1700s in England. Mm. So, you know, franchising has been around.
I miss that era, but that's okay.
Yeah, I was paying attention to other things than myself. With. I don't know how the age demographic of your listeners, but back in the 1980s, Congress took a look at the franchise industry and said, you know, wow, this is crazy. This is like becoming the Wild West. And, people think of Gallagher with, Sledge-O-Matic and, all of that stuff. And they put a handle on it and took it over and started doing total oversight. They grabbed the franchise disclosure document, which was at the time anywhere from 1,500 pages to 2,500 pages, and they created a format which they actually used the term legalese, saying that there was not one sentence to be allowed in any franchise disclosure document that could be qualified or considered legalese.
Huh.
Basically, it meant that if there was a sentence you read and you went, what, and had to read it again, that was legalese. So they got rid of all of that, set it up with 23 different items in the franchise disclosure document, primarily so someone could take a FDD, franchise disclosure document, of a pizzeria and set it next to a senior care and set that next to a laundromat, and they could go across 111, and it would all be the same, about that information. For example, item number 3 is all about litigation. Who has had any kind of litigation? Who's within the franchise organization? Who sued them? Who has, have they had any, bankruptcies, anything like that? So you can actually look, you can go to item 3 of a pizzeria and say, oh, this person, has no litigation. Item 3 in the, senior care has no litigation. Maybe item 3 in the, the third one, somebody got, they had a bankruptcy. So anyway, they made it easy. And then, do you remember Chi-Chi's?
I do.
Mexican restaurants?
Yeah. They had fried ice cream.
Yeah. When was the last time you saw Chi-Chi's Mexican restaurant?
I remember them, but I can't
remember
seeing them.
Right, yeah. I mean, if there's anything, there's a jar of salsa in the grocery store.
Oh, right, right.
So what happened there was, back in the early 90s, one of their franchisees decided to go outside of the system and go off from the preferred vendor list and bought tomatoes from someone who was not, had not been vetted by the corporate offices. Mm. And 3 people died and 14 people got sick. And Chi-Chi's got sued. And Chi-Chi's closed. Over 270 restaurants. It was like a small heart attack to the GNP. And Congress again said, whoa, that can never happen again. So they rewrote the franchise agreement so that no individual rogue franchisee can do anything that's going to disrupt or do damage to any other franchisee or the corporate entity. So Congress really has total insight. A perfect example, a couple years ago, well, maybe 3 years ago now, I don't know if you even saw this, ICE went in and raided like 99 7-Elevens. It was in like April of maybe 2020 or 2019, something like that. And I remember seeing it on the news at 7:30 in the morning, and by 9 o'clock, it was no longer a story. Because of the franchise agreement, corporate 7-Eleven went in. They took all 99 of those 7-Elevens. They fired all of the people who had been involved with it. ICE took the illegal immigrants who were working them, and probably by 1 o'clock in the afternoon, those 99 7-Elevens were up for sale.
Wow.
And nobody else of the other 1,100 even blinked.
Interesting. I want to get to what you do, Dan.
Sure.
So what are the ways you help someone who's interested in obtaining a franchise?
Well, I approach this industry completely different than the others who do what I do. And I will point out there's only about 1,500 of us on the whole planet to do this. Hmm. I like to say that there's more people involved in the NFL than there is doing franchise consulting. What I do is I like to talk to my clients and find out what kind of lifestyle they're looking to get and what kind of income they are looking to attain from a business. The franchise industry is so dynamic nowadays. Literally, perfect example. I've got 23 senior care franchises in my portfolio.
Wow.
And they do almost exactly the same thing. No one's reinventing the wheel on non-medical senior care in-home stuff at all.
Yeah.
But you got 12,000 people a day turning 65, and your average territory has 27,000 qualified seniors. If you've got 50 clients, you're doing $1 million a year in revenue. So, it's just I could add 10 more. So what I talk to people about is, again, lifestyle. Do you want to go to dinner once a month? Do you want to go to dinner once a week? Do you want to go to dinner four times a year in Europe? What do you want? Because this industry is so tight that once we figure out what you're looking for, what kind of lifestyle, what kind of money, and how much you have to invest, then we just pick businesses that are going to get you there. In the franchise industry, about 80% of people sell their franchises between year 7 and 10. So it's an investment. It's a tool. It's a tool. It just happens to be you're a business owner.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what do you want to do? Do you want to be involved? Do you want to be day-to-day? Some people have to have their hands in the pot, they got to be there.
Right.
Others just want to sort of manage the manager and be semi-absentee. So I help people walk through this industry. It's big. There's 3,800, franchises operating every day. You get, $13 million a year or $13 billion a year in revenue. It's the fourth largest industry in the country.
Hmm. Well, what's your background? Have you always been in the franchise world? What got you interested in it?
Actually, I spent almost 30 years running nonprofits. My whole mantra in most of my life has been if I can get people to feel good about where they live, they'll get involved with where they live. And once they get involved with where they live, you start building community. So, I did a lot with culture, economic development. I used to travel around the state of New York and do what I called my dog and pony show for municipalities, helping them figure out how to do something with second floor Main Street, all of that. So in 2008, I got interested. I started consulting for nonprofits. And I got interested in franchises. I was sitting in a parking lot with in the car while my wife and youngest daughter went into this little shop that had, tens of thousands of fingernail polish colors. And I'm sitting in this plaza and suddenly I'm just looking at all of these little businesses and these little shops and I'm thinking, wow, these people are brilliant. These people are great. Look at these names. Look at these niches. Look at these things. These people are franchises. I got to figure this out. And so I started getting interested in the franchise industry. 2014, my father turned 90. I'm an old West Virginia hillbilly, transplanted into Vermont, and I was raised to take care of your own. So I told my board I'm quitting, and I'm going to turn my avocation into my vocation. I went home and chased my father around for 2 years.
Huh. Wow. Let's head to Randolph Center. We've got Mary. Good morning, Mary.
Hi, good morning, Rick.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dan. I sure wish I had been able to talk to you back in 1989 when we bought our franchise. We purchased a Grease Monkey franchise, which was a Quick Lube.
Right.
They were out of Denver, Colorado. And, we ran that. We were down in New Jersey, ran that for a few years, and it did not turn out well.
What was the problem, Mary? What was the issue you had with Grease Monkey?
Yeah, what happened, it really wasn't with the franchise itself, but there was road construction happening in front of our business after about I guess maybe about a year and a half, 2 years. And it just stopped our business. I mean, we count it on 80-some thousand cars going by a day and getting a percentage of those cars. And that's what happened. So it's very unfortunate.
All right. Thanks for
that. Location is vital. The majority of franchises nowadays have in-house real estate companies that will find the site for you, negotiate your lease, usually build the thing out, hand you the key afterwards.
Hmm. Dan, how long do you normally work with someone until they acquire a franchise?
Well, that goes anywhere from, I've had people go 2 weeks, and I've also had people for a couple of years. You know, my services are free, so you know, I've worked it out with the franchise companies that if I bring them a qualified candidate, and at the end of the day, they actually award this person a franchise, they'll pay me. They will compensate me. So I get to work with my clients for as long as it takes to determine whether or not it's even a good idea for them to buy a franchise. You know, not everybody is, you know, ready for a franchise or can do it. I'm also, I don't know if you're, are you familiar with SCORE?
What SCORE?
SCORE is, it used to be, the acronym was the Service Corps of Retired Executives.
Oh, I don't know SCORE.
It's a nonprofit. It's the longest running business mentorship in America. There's SCORE for Central New York. I'm a SCORE mentor here in Vermont as well. I do mainly nationally and work with nonprofits. But yeah, it's, you know, there are, there's a lot of ways that, you know, you can approach this, you know, this industry. And if you come to me, SCORE is one. You can go to score.org and talk to, you know, people, or you can come to me. They're all, we're all free, basically. I do a lot of educating. You know, I've got 700 franchises in my portfolio. And it's, you said 21 industries. I'm in 30 different industries. Yeah, there's, you know, it's again, it's the fourth largest. They think that the franchise industry will move into the second largest industry in America, right behind tourism, by 2025.
So, Dan, I call you up, you know, and I'm interested in acquiring a franchise. You're not going to charge me a fee. What do I get from you? What do you help me, you know, get
from here to there? We would start about, you know, what you're looking to acquire. You know, I'm whether you're looking to transition into a business, whether you're looking to add something to your portfolio. You know, side hustle is a, you know, is a very popular term. You know, maybe you're looking for a side hustle. You're looking for something that you can own and make, you know, 100,000 or plus a year off of it, and only have to work about 5 to 7 hours a week overseeing, you know, the person who's actually doing the work for you.
Right.
I discuss these things with you. We find out what you're looking for, and then I start making suggestions. I will send you emails on businesses. I will talk to you about these businesses, and then once we've determined a company or a model that is really of interest, I'll then facilitate an introduction with the franchise company. Then I sit on the sidelines with you, and, you know, I give you, like, you know, I've got questions. I've developed, you know, worksheets of questions to grill these guys with, you know, because the bottom line is, you know, this is a big chunk of change. You're going out there to spend a lot of money, and, you know, I like my karma to stay good. I want you to know everything you can. And, you know, my wife thinks it's hokey, but, you know, I like getting Christmas cards from my clients, you know, because if I get a Christmas card, they're still happy.
Yeah. Should we send one to that Dan guy? Oh, yeah, Dan, we like him.
Right. Changed my life. And, you know, and the other thing about, like I was saying about the nonprofit, you know, if I help somebody buy a business, I've helped that family. You know, and if they get a business that's, you know, got employees, I've helped more people there. And, you know, if it's a business that's a brick and mortar, you know, who doesn't like a shiny penny on Main Street that just showed up of a new business? It makes everybody feel good.
Yeah. So when we're talking about franchising, Dan, what kind of investment, you know, minimum to, you know, I'm sure it can go all the way up. Yeah. But, you know, what amount are you, is someone coming to you looking to invest to acquire a franchise?
Well, my portfolio ranges from 14,000 to a couple of million.
Yeah, okay.
The majority of the people who are coming to me are looking at businesses that are, you know, under 200,000, that, you know, they've got, they, you know, they've got themselves maybe 50 grand and mm-hmm. they want to do a SBA, you know, $150,000, you know, loan.
Right.
There's quick loans, SBA, the
small business. You
know, out of the 700 franchises that I have, 685 are SBA registered and approved. Mm-hmm. You know, and I also work with various finance companies. I also help people with E2 and EB5 visas, you know, who are looking to get into the country. I work with a lot of people in Canada, and several times a year I have clients from, you know, overseas who are looking to come to America and, you know, start a business. So I'll help them with an E2 visa.
Yeah.
I also can connect my clients with franchise attorneys. You know, I tell my clients, you know, if you're going to get an attorney, you want somebody who knows what they're doing. The last thing you need to do is pay somebody to teach themselves how to read a franchise disclosure document.
Well done. I want to ask you, with a couple minutes left, because there are some industries that Vermont could use more outlets of, and I'm going to bring up child care, and you've mentioned senior care facilities. How might franchising help fill that shortage in those businesses in Vermont?
Well, I've probably got 18 to 23 different types of child care, which run the gambit from babies up to, you know, STEM, you know, where they're teaching these kids, tutoring courses, all sorts of things on those levels. And with senior care, you know, I think 20 years ago, they coined the phrase silver tsunami. And Vermont, apparently, from what I understand, is the number two oldest demographic for population in the country. And, you know, it would be a good idea to, you know, my senior care's run anywhere from having people help organize the life of a senior and how they're going to move to having in-home care, to creating residential homes and turning them into 24/7, 365, you know, senior facilities, to literally, you know, helping the families at the end with, you know, estate sales and stuff. I mean, the senior industry literally runs the gamut. And it is, as I said, I have 23, you know, senior non-medicals. These things average $1.7 million a year in revenue, and the owners are averaging, if they're hands-on and running the shop, you know, running the thing, they're doing 35% of that in net, you know, and if they've got a manager, they're still doing around 19%. So, you know, I mean, it's very lucrative. Most of the franchises that offer semi-absentee literally are, you know, you're making a phone call or two a week, you're looking at the, you know, some reports and some spreadsheets, and you're doing $125,000 to $250,000 a year. And you can do it for less than $300,000.
Dan Hayes is a certified franchise consultant based here in Vermont and the owner of 100 Acre Consulting. You can learn more at 100acreconsulting.com. Dan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, it was great. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity, and, you know, let's to keep up the good work.
All right. Thank you, too. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Feel free to suggest guests or topics by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes or subscribe to our podcast of Vermont Viewpoint at WDEVradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we talk to Sarah Stewart Taylor about her new book, Hang With, the founder of Switchback Brewing, and Meat Potter, Laura Zindel.